All right, so we are into one of the really, really fascinating places in the Scripture. How many of you would say you know a lot about David and Jonathan, that relationship? By brave show of hands. Brave, okay, Deanne's saying she does. Dan, you were nodding. You feel pretty confident you know the story. So help me out here. Give me broad strokes. What's the story behind David and Jonathan, their relationship? Yeah, so great points. We see that their relationship is kind of, it just sparks off right at the very beginning. Like you mentioned, they act like they've known each other their whole lives, and there's great faithfulness. They make a covenant with each other, which is really important to understand about their relationship. And Jonathan is so devoted to David that he's willing to go against his father by means of supporting David and fulfilling that covenant that he's made with him. Dan, is there anything you want to add to that? Yeah, Jonathan, yeah, that's a great point. He hands over his robe, and it is, I'm saying this out loud so we make sure we get it recorded, we make sure we get your point. And so it's symbolic of handing over the kingship, even. We're going to talk about that more tonight, because I think that's really, really important. Not only the handing over the kingship, but the exchanging of clothes is a really significant thing. What else do we know about, what do we know about Jonathan the person? So just from what we've said, and there's more here, but you guys really hit the big stuff. What does this tell us about the character of Jonathan? What kind of man is Jonathan? Compassion? Loyal? Okay, now loyal is interesting. Why do you say loyal? Yeah, so Jonathan demonstrates this unbelievable loyalty towards David, but what about loyalty towards his father? Is Jonathan disloyal towards his father? What do you think, Betty? Wait, are you saying that he was disloyal to Saul or he was loyal to Saul? He was disloyal to his father. Okay, how many think that he was disloyal to his father? No, I mean, you're absolutely right about the fact. Saul wanted to kill him, and he demonstrates that he shows this great loyalty to David, but does Jonathan's loyalty to David necessitate disloyalty towards Saul? Saul calls his son a son of a whore. I don't know if you guys noticed that. You have to read between the lines. When Jonathan stands against Saul, he says, "You son of an unfaithful woman." Okay, well, that's kind of probably a churched-up way of saying it. What does that say about you, Saul? Like, you're out there marrying unfaithful women? Like, he calls him a son of a whore because he says, "Don't I know that you have allied yourself against the son of Jesse to your shame and the shame of the mother who bore you?" So Saul sees this as a huge act of disloyalty. And Saul even attempts to tell Jonathan, like, as if Jonathan were stupid, "Don't you realize that as long as the son of Jesse lives, you will never inherit the throne?" That's Saul's pitch to Jonathan. If the son of Jesse lives, you never inherit the throne. So is Jonathan disloyal to Saul? I mean, he disobeys him, right? Go ahead, Dan. That's a really good point. So I think what you're getting at is that maybe a failure to obey doesn't necessarily mean disobedience. Is that a fair thing to say? A failure to obey doesn't equal, I shouldn't say disobedience, it doesn't equal disloyalty. Was Jonathan being disloyal when he refused to kill David? Was he being disloyal to Saul? Okay, why not? Why not, Dan? So he's being loyal to his father by disobeying him because he's protecting his father from doing something that would be... So, were you going to say something, Dan? Oh, I couldn't tell if you were switching pages. Okay. So, yeah, this is an important theme. And I'm gonna jump out of Saul, and I'm going to jump right into modern-day applications for today. Okay? And so my question is, what does it mean to honor your father and mother? Show them respect, okay? Is it limited to respect? Obedience? Loyalty? Honor your father and mother and live long in the land that the Lord is going to give you. Paul quotes this and says, this is the first law that comes with a promise. All the other laws, in fact, it's the only law in the Ten Commandments, it's the only law in the Decalogue that comes with a promise. Everything else, the promise is implicit, right? The promise of, if you honor God, your life will be better. But the fifth commandment just comes out and says it. Honor your father and mother and live long in the land which the Lord your God is about to give you. So, I mean, that's significant, but what does that mean? What does it mean to honor your father and mother? And I don't think that, go ahead. Yeah, care for them when they need care. So I had a dilemma. Well, I didn't have a dilemma. I was helping a person work through a dilemma a few years ago. And this person did not want his daughter to marry another guy. The man that she was interested in, he did not approve of. And the question was to this young woman who was out of the house. She was a grown woman, had her own job, did all, you know, was in control of her life, was, did she have to break off this relationship to please her father? I'm curious what you guys think about this. Okay, Deanne doesn't think so. Jean, you look like you're thinking. Why not, Jean? So I guess the question is, and this might sound silly, but all of you guys are older and you guys have adult children. What's the difference between the daughter being in the home and the daughter being out of the home? Why is it that even if she's an adult, you think that, presumably you think the father should have some say in her romantic life if she's living under his roof and he doesn't if she isn't? Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying? Okay, what's the difference? Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead, Gene. Why is that different? I'm not trying to just grill you individually. Other people can jump in, but. So hopefully by the time your kids are adults, you've made the impact that you need to, so they don't make drastically self-destructive decisions. But okay, so switching it now for the girl, why is she not bound to obey her father in that situation? I mean, does anybody think that she should? I'm not trying to pick fights here. Does anybody think that that would be an act of dishonoring her parents if she went against her parents in that situation? Maybe it's both parents. Just for hypothetical sake, let's say it's both parents. Is that dishonoring her parents? That's a really good wrinkle. I mean, it is. Because I think what Betty has said, what Gina said, and maybe Deanne, maybe I think you might have implied it, is that you hope that you raise your children to make wise decisions. And Betty, you were right there. You're saying you raise your daughter in this circumstance. You raise your daughter, and you need to respect her decisions, because your goal is to raise somebody who can make respectable decisions. And you know, she's out of your home. She's her own person. Like, and you don't get to dictate. So it's not really dishonoring somebody if they're just not doing what you want them to do. But then Dan brings that up, like, well, what if he's an unbeliever? I don't know, because now it's clearly a self-destructive decision. It's a biblically forbidden decision. Does that change anything? But I think Dan's question is if she insists on dating or marrying the guy who's an unbeliever, is that dishonoring to her parents to go against their wishes and marry the unbeliever? Go ahead. I know I was going to say something like what you are, and I think my answer to that is, in that situation, it is dishonoring to her parents, but not because she's disobeying them, but because she's doing something that is of itself dishonorable, and it dishonors the family. And in America, we don't really live in an honor-shame culture like in the East. And in the East, especially in New Testament times, most people lived in big patriarchal homes. It would be multiple generations of families. One cultural historian has described the family home in the ancient world as being a collection of survivors. It's not really a family. It's just a random collection of cousins, brothers, nieces, uncles, and great-grandparents who just happened to survive the incredibly random killing of the ancient world, of accident and disease and warfare. And it isn't a family in the nuclear family sense that we think of it. It's this weird extended family living under the same roof. And in that culture, especially in Rome, you have the paterfamilias laws. If you're not familiar with the paterfamilias, paterfamilias in Latin is the father of the family, and the father of the family under Roman law had absolute sovereign control over the life and limb and property of everyone who lived under his roof. And a man did not become a man. He did not become his own legal person. He did not have his own legal agency until he was adopted by his father. When the Bible talks about adoption, the question is, are they using adoption in the Roman legal sense? The Roman legal sense of adoption is a young man who's living in his father's home has grown up. He is now an adult, and his father is letting go of the legal power that he has over his child as the father of the family. So when a Roman father adopts his son, it isn't necessarily that he's taking somebody from another family and bringing him into his family like we think of adoption. That was part of it. That was something you could do. But it's the father saying, I now recognize this man as my son. He has his own moral legal agency, and I do not have power over him. And a lot of times that also came with a guarantee of an inheritance that could not be revoked. Adoption in the Roman world was irrevocable. So if I adopt Phineas, you know, under Roman law, I can never undo that. It's irrevocable. So that's kind of the thing that we have to think about is that their culture, their views of what was dishonoring might be very different from ours. Does that mean ours are wrong or that theirs are wrong? Okay. I agree. I agree with you 100%. But my question is, how do you not fall into moral relativism? Are the biblical laws written in such a way that culture can influence how those laws are enforced? If the Bible says honor your father and mother, is it possible that it's okay for honoring your father and mother to look different in America in 2020 than it did in 20 AD? Marcia, you're saying yeah, you think so? Does that weaken the Bible? So why is it that some laws in the Bible don't ever seem to move? Like murder is always murder, right? Like I don't know that there's a cultural definition of murder. Well, in America, I guess there's some laws just don't seem to have any kind of flexibility. Some of them do. This is not what I intended to talk about tonight. So forgive me for drawing us away from David and Jonathan, but. Something I will throw out, just because this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and it's something for you guys to chew on, and you can think about it, and if you think it sounds crazy, just tell me you think it sounds crazy. But right now our culture cannot decide what a man and a woman are. Like, okay. But the question is, what is manhood and what is womanhood? What do those things look like? What do masculinity and femininity look like? And the problem is that any definition you propose of what masculinity is, you can find a woman who has those masculine tendencies. So you know, you get the classic answer, and it's like, well, what are the male virtues? Which is ironic because virtue just means manliness in Latin. So like, what are the male virtues? Well, courage. Well, wait, women can't be brave? That's dumb. Like, of course women can be brave. It's like, oh, well, strength. Women can't be strong. Oh, okay. Well, what are the feminine? What are the feminine virtues? Even though that's ironic. It's an oxymoron. What are the feminine virtues? Well, kindness. Oh, wait, men aren't supposed to be kind? Compassion, gentleness. Men aren't supposed to be that? So the problem is that the best we can come up with is a spectrum of culture, right? And so my thought is, Look at the law that God gives us about cross-dressing. It says, a man shall not wear women's clothes, women shall not wear men's clothes. You can examine Leviticus. It doesn't describe what those clothes look like. It doesn't say men can't wear dresses. My Scottish, you know, forebears would have been shamed then, you know. It doesn't say men can't wear skirts. It doesn't say women can't wear pants. It just says men can't wear women's clothes. It seems like God gives human cultures enough leeway to say, you know what, you, America, you get to decide what male clothes are and women's clothes are. It's probably going to be different than what Israel says male clothes and women's clothes are. But every culture gets to determine these things. So I think some people, are the social and theological liberals, are kind of right. There is some fluidity to this. But there's also something unmovable, which is what Jim mentioned, which is if you have male genitalia, you're a man. If you have female genitalia, you're a woman. That's immovable. Is there more to it than that? There are certainly tendencies, right? Men tend to behave in a certain way. Women tend to behave in another way. You know, Eliza, we didn't force dresses and dolls on her. She wanted them. Phineas has really no interest in it. He wants to paint his toes, but like he doesn't have any interest in dolls. He doesn't have any interest in dresses. Eliza did. We didn't force that on either one of them. It's just natural. So anyways, I'll shut up. That's not what we're supposed to talk about. David and Jonathan. So we've all agreed, right? Jonathan is not disloyal to David, or to Saul. We know he's not disloyal to David. Why does Jonathan love David? I mean, we know why David loves Jonathan, because Jonathan is the initiator in this relationship. Why? We know why David loves Jonathan. Jonathan shows him nothing but love and kindness, and the loving kindness of the Bible talks about, the chesed. He shows him compassion and mercy. Why does Jonathan love David? Yeah, it doesn't, does it? God, were you going to say something, Linda? Yeah, you're right. There's, we don't know, it's a strange friendship, because probably the best scholarship I've seen says that Jonathan is probably anywhere from 15 to 20 years older than David. So it's not like they're the same age. You know, Jonathan's oldest son is probably just a few years younger than David at this point. So this is almost a father-son relationship, but it's treated as a friendship, and it is a friendship. But I think you make a great point. He's seen what David has done. A lot of times we read the Bible just in this tiny microscopic way of only looking at chapter 18, and we're like, well, why would Jonathan love him so much? And it's like, well, I guess he killed Goliath, but we forget David has been in Saul's service for some time now, and he's been caring for his father and showing love to his father. And then what I mentioned on the sermon on Sunday is, what's David doing? David is acting like the king. David has just delivered Israel from somebody, making a great shame and affront to them from Goliath and from the Philistines. So Jonathan has a lot of reasons to love David, because of his care for his family, his loyalty to his father, his willingness to risk his own life for the good of the nation. Like, Jonathan has a lot of reasons, but Jonathan's also the crown prince. This isn't normally the way crown princes treat other people, and it's certainly not the way crown princes typically treat people who are seen as viable threats to the throne. We don't know when word got out that Samuel had anointed David as the coming king, but word gets out pretty soon. And so did Jonathan know this at the time? He knows it later. Jonathan continues to help David even when Jonathan knows that David is going to inherit the throne. In fact, Jonathan says, he will inherit the throne and I will be second to him. Now, here's my question. Man, I wish we had a lot more time tonight. Jonathan does not become second to David, because Jonathan dies with his father in the war against the Philistines. Could you imagine a better man than Jonathan to be king? If the theme, let me put it in the context of 1 Samuel. The theme of 1 Samuel is that God exalts the humble and he brings down the proud. Jonathan is caught in the middle of this. We are in the middle of the narrative of the fall of Saul. David continues to trend upwards towards the throne, and Saul continues to trend downwards. He's already being attacked by a demon. He's trending towards madness. He's no longer able to go out and fight the battles of his nation that he should be against Goliath. You know, we've got this, you know, it's kind of making an X mark. David's going up, Saul's going down, and Jonathan's caught in the middle of this. But Jonathan is not proud. He's not arrogant. He's humble. He's godly. He shows compassion. Was there a better potential king than Jonathan? Was he? I'm being serious here. I know that because David is in the Bible and because he wrote the Psalms and because we love David, that we're supposed to say David was the better option. Was he? Flip forwards with me. When David is running for his life, chapter 25. Everybody knows this. David and Abigail, right? Great, beautiful love story, okay? It's still a better love story than Twilight, but that's not setting the bar very high. Okay, so David comes, and he guards the property of a man who's shearing his sheep. He has a large flock of sheep and goats. David surrounds his property and protects them from robbers, which apparently, according to some commentators, was actually not an unknown practice. And it was considered a kind practice that if somebody brought a band of soldiers to surround and protect somebody's sheep, that you would give them a gift. That it was that was just considered the cultural expectation. And David, and David expects this to be fulfilled. He says, I've done my part of this like unwritten cultural law. I've protected your sheep. You have a large flock. Can you please spare something for me and my men? And what's the response of Nabal? Who is this son of Jesse? Why should I do this? We're going to talk about David and Abigail, so I don't want to ruin the story. But look at David's response. David's response is important here. Put on your swords. May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything is left living at Nabal's house. That's a pretty ugly side of David. I mean, David right now is acting like a Middle Eastern warlord. He's not acting like the sweet psalmist of Israel. He's acting like a warlord. And thank God that Abigail is there. And look at her words. She's obsequious. She is fawning over David. But what does she say? That she will to protect him from the staggering guilt of needless bloodshed. Abigail is really nice, but she goes out of her way to say, if you do this, this will be hundreds of counts of murder. Like, this is indefensible murder if you go forward with this. And to David's credit, he backs off, right? But thank God Abigail was there. But David is prepared to do mass murder. Like, I'm not trying to paint David any blacker than he is, but I'm just saying, like, let's look at the man for who he really was. Can you see Jonathan doing this? Because I can't. David and Bathsheba, and then the incident with Uriah. Can you see Jonathan doing that? I'll be honest, I can't. I don't see Jonathan doing that. Jonathan's already an old man. He's an older man. He's probably nearing his 40s, if he's not in his 40s already. He's been tested. We see no great moral flaws in him. And when he's given the opportunity to act badly, to act selfishly, he refuses to do it. In fact, he gives David his own clothes. Now, giving him his clothes, as has been pointed out, this is a way of handing over the throne, maybe symbolically. It's a way of also saying, we are one. This is unity between us. Now, we don't think of it that way, but you got to remember, first of all, people didn't own very many sets of clothes in the ancient world. You know, Jonathan probably owned more sets of clothes because he was the prince. But people didn't own lots and lots of sets of clothes. So sharing clothes with somebody, one, it would smell like them because they didn't live in a time of modern detergent. He shares clothes with him after the battle. It smells like him. It's made for him. It is built to his size. He is saying we are one. It's a way of showing unity. This still happens today. People forget, you know, we talk about this, and you see high school girls, they're constantly wearing their friends' clothes. People exchange clothes today. Like, we don't think of it as being a common thing, but people do it. It's a way of saying we're one. So here's my question. And you can say that I'm a bad preacher for saying this, but is it possible that God did not put the potentially best king on the throne? Is it possible that God prevented Jonathan, who would have been a better king, from sitting on the throne to put David on the throne for his own purposes? I'm sorry, I want to hear you. I got to turn this off. Hello? It's my wife, and she hangs up literally the moment I answer the phone. Okay, what were you saying, Betty? If you're saying if Jonathan would have become king, David probably never would have, and then I didn't catch the rest of what you're saying. I don't know. I don't know that any of the only prophecy that talks about Messiah coming that implies that he might have had to come from David's line would be that the throne shall not depart from between Judah's feet until the scepter comes to him who it belongs. It's in the end of Genesis. And I know I'm paraphrasing that text. I think I butchered it a little bit. We know that Messiah will come from Judah, but beyond that, we don't know. Now Jonathan is a Benjamite, so he will not be the ancestor of the Messiah unless through a maternal line, through a daughter of his. So you're right. The Messiah has to come through the line of Judah, but there are no prophecies yet that he'll come from David's line. So, I mean, if you mean in the infinite foreknowledge of God, if he wanted David to be an ancestor, certainly. But simply on the basis of who would have been a better king, I'm not convinced. In fact, I'm not only not convinced that David was a better king than Jonathan would have been, I'm pretty certain that Jonathan would have been a better king than David from what we see of their lives. Now, granted, no one has ever taken a picture of my life like a picture of David's life has been taken. We see David at his very worst. If you saw me at your very worst, you wouldn't like me very much. So I'm not trying to bash David. I'm just saying, I mean, some pretty dark stuff in his life, and we haven't covered all of it tonight. So my question is, if I'm right, which there's no guarantee that I am, why would God not give Israel the best king that they could potentially have? No, Gene, that's a lazy answer. It's a truthful answer, yes. Yes, who are we to question God? Yes, that is one of my least favorite verses in the Bible. All my Calvinist friends, they tell me, they who are you to talk back to God? I'm like, you're presuming you're right. Like, you can't just throw that in people's faces. I mean, you're right. We can't question God. His purposes are right, but what I'm saying is, how is it within God's purpose to give Israel not the best potential king they have? And maybe it's what Betty's saying. Maybe it had to come through the Davidic line, but I don't see why it had to. I don't know why David has to be the ancestor of Jesus. I don't know. Is it possible? And I'm throwing this out here. I'm just asking, is it possible that Jonathan, that we're supposed to reflect on this, that the nation of Israel misses out on Jonathan, who could have been the greatest king Israel ever had because of the sins of his father? As we see David start so well and slowly kind of fail badly, David starts very well. David does not end well. That's the tragedy of almost all of the kings of Israel, is they don't end well, which is part of why the Old Testament is so depressing to some people, because we're still anticipating Messiah. Of course David isn't perfect. He's not Messiah. He's not Jesus. But are we supposed to reflect on this and say, gosh, why didn't God want Jonathan to be king? Jonathan was awesome. Jonathan was not proud. There was not a proud bone in Jonathan's body. He's ready to see this kid, young enough to be his son, be king instead of him and say, I will happily be second in command to you. No, you're right. I mean, it's pure speculation. We don't know what Jonathan would have done given the power if he had gotten that power. He may have failed miserably. He may have, you know, that old saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I don't know that that's true. I think absolute power brings out the corruption that's already in people. And maybe Jonathan was prevented from becoming king, because maybe he would have become very corrupt. Maybe I've got it completely backwards. Maybe once Jonathan finally got that power, he would have become brutal and dictatorial, and we would have seen an ugly part of his nature. I just don't think so. Given the opportunity he had to be a bad prince, he always was a good prince. And so my prediction is he would have continued to have been a good king. David, we have peppered through his whole life. We have these little signs that, like, David's a godly man, but David's a godly man with some glaring flaws in his character. Again, I'm not saying I don't have glaring flaws in my character. I'm just saying we see David's, right? We get little hints, like the whole incident with David and Abigail, or with Nabal and Abigail. We see a little hint of it when they're at the battle with Goliath. Now, on the sermon, I didn't mention this, but I wanted to. But I wanted to keep it under an hour. So I didn't mention the fact that, well, maybe David's brothers weren't entirely wrong. Like, maybe they did know David pretty well, and maybe David was kind of arrogant around the household. Like, maybe he was an upstart, and maybe when they say, we know how wicked your heart is, you just came to see the battle. Maybe when his brothers hear about, like, David trying to gain power and get influence in the country, maybe they weren't entirely off base. I don't know. I've already gone a couple minutes past, so I appreciate your time. But I think it's worth thinking about, because obviously we cannot get certain answers. We can't have certainty on this. But the fact that Jonathan never becomes king is one of these huge question marks in the Bible of, why do we have this amazing person in the Bible, and then they never seem to get what they deserve? They never seem to have the influence that they should have. It seems like a lost opportunity. Well, look at Abigail. I mean, this will be the point when we talk about Abigail, is David marries her. He has a child with her, but we don't hear boo about Abigail after that. Why not? Like, here's an intelligent, godly, compassionate woman who could have been a really good queen to David, but she just fades out. Why? Why would you let a woman like that fade away? Fade into insignificance in your life? This is one of those questions in the Bible that we don't have a very good answer for. But does anybody else have any final points before we finish up? That's a really good potential interpretation. Even if that's not what happened, which, I mean, that very well could be what happened. Even if that's not what happened, it's still good wisdom that all of us need to know. Like, we all need to know our own limits. Like, we all need to know, like, thus far and no further. Like, it's like, I can trust my ability to be faithful to God by living through faith and by the power of the Holy Spirit in these circumstances. But outside of these circumstances, I really don't know, because I haven't been tested there. And I don't trust myself there. Or I know that I will fail when I get there. Like an alcoholic, you know, a recovering alcoholic. It's like, okay, like, they're probably fine, but going to a bar would probably be an unwise decision, because they're probably pretty strong on their own when they can control their environment. But you get them out of an environment they can control when they're surrounded by temptations, and it's like, this was probably an unwise decision to put myself around these temptations. So I think that's a really good theory. It's just as good and probably maybe even better than what I proposed. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Absolutely. And then why? It's a tragedy is what it is, and that's what the Old Testament is a lot of tragedies. So anybody else, final thoughts before we wrap up for tonight? Well, thank you, everybody. Sorry it was kind of squirrely tonight, kind of jumping around from place to place, but I thank you for your patience, and thank you for all the interaction. It was a lot of fun.